say to all this, needing time to think it out. He gestured for me to take the chair on the other side of the writing table, and without thinking of it, I did. "But wasn't it meant to happen, Roman?" he asked. "Weren't they meant to meet their death in the sands, silent, unmoving, like statues cast there after a city is sacked by the conquering army? And were we not meant to die too? Look at Egypt. What is Egypt, I ask you again, but the granary of Rome? Were they not meant to burn there day after day, while all of us burned like stars the world over?"
"Where are they?" I asked. "Why do you want to know?" he sneered. "Why should I give you the secret? They cannot be hacked to pieces, they are too strong for that. A knife will barely pierce their skin. You cut them and you cut us, burn them and you burn us, and whatever they make us feel, they feel only a particle of it because their age protects them. And yet to destroy every one of us, you have merely to bring them annoyance, the blood they do not even seem to need. Maybe their minds are connected to ours as well. Maybe the sorrow we felt, the misery, the horror at the fate of the world itself comes from their minds, as locked in their chambers they dream. No, I cannot tell you where they are, can I? Until I decide for certain that I am indifferent, that it is time for us to die out."
"Where are they?" I said again.
"Why should I not sink them into the very depths of sea?" he asked, "until such time as the earth herself heaves them up into the sunlight on the crest of a great wave." I didn't answer. I was watching him, wondering at his excitement, understanding it but in awe of it just the same. "Why should I not bury them in the depths of the earth? I mean the darkest depths, beyond the faintest sounds of life, and let them lie in silence there, no matter what they think and feel." What answer could I give? I watched him. I waited until he seemed calmer. He looked at me, and his face became tranquil and almost trusting.
"Tell me how they became the mother and the father," I said.
"Why?"
"You know damn good and well why. I want to know.
Why did you come into my bedroom if you didn't mean to tell me?" I asked again. "So what if I did?" he said bitterly. "So what if I wanted to see the Roman with my own eyes? We will die, and you will die with us. So I wanted to see our magic in a new form. Who worships us now, after all? Yellow-haired warriors in the northern forests? Old, old Egyptians in secret crypts beneath the sands? We do not live in the temples of Greece and Rome. We never did. And yet they celebrate our myth, the only myth. They call the names of the mother and the father."
"I don't give a damn," I said. "You know I don't. We are alike, you and I. I won't go back to the northern forests to make a race of gods for those people. But I came here to know, and you must tell me."
"All right. So that you can understand the futility of it, so that you can understand the silence of the mother and the father, I will tell. But mark my words, I may yet bring us all down. I may yet burn the mother and the father in the heat of a kiln. But we will dispense with lengthy initiations and high-blown language. We will do away with the myths that died in the sand the day the sun shone on the mother and the father. I will tell you what all these scrolls left by the father and the mother reveal. Set down your candle, and listen to me."
10.
"What the scrolls will tell you," he said, "if you could decipher them, is that we have two human beings, Akasha and Enkil, who had come into Egypt from some other, older land. This was in the time long before the first writing, before the first pyramids, when the Egyptians were still cannibals and hunted for the bodies of enemies to eat. Akasha and Enkil directed the people away from these practices. They were worshippers of the Good Mother Earth, and they taught the Egyptians how to sow seed in the Good Mother, and how to herd animals for meat and milk and skins. In all probability they were not alone as they taught these things, but rather the leaders of a people who had come with them from older cities whose names are now lost beneath the sands of Lebanon, their monuments laid waste. Whatever is the truth, these were benevolent rulers, these two, in whom the good of others was the commanding value. As the good mother was the nourishing mother, and wished for all men to live in peace, and they decided all questions of justice for the emerging land. Perhaps they would have passed into myth in some benign form, had it not been for a disturbance in the house of the royal steward, which began with the antics of a demon that hurled the furniture about. Now this was no more than a common demon, the kind one hears of in all lands at all times. He devils those who live in a certain place for a certain while. Perhaps he enters into the body of some innocent, and roars through her mouth with a loud voice. He may cause the innocent one to belch obscenities and carnal invitations to those around her. Do you know of these things? I nodded. I told him you always heard such stories. Such a demon was supposed to have possessed a Vestal Virgin in Rome. She made lewd overtures to all those around her, her face turning purple with exertion, then fainted. But the demon had somehow been driven out. I thought the girl was simply mad, I said. That she was, shall we say, not suited to be a Vestal Virgin. Of course, he said with a note of rich irony, and I would assume the same thing, and so would most any intelligent man walking the streets of Alexandria above us. Yet such stories come and go, and if they are remarkable for one thing, it is that they do not affect the course of human events. These demons rather trouble some household, some person, and then they are gone into oblivion, and we are right where we started again. Precisely, I said. But you understand this was old, old Egypt. This was a time when men ran from the thunder, or ate the bodies of the dead to absorb their souls. I understand, I said. And this good King Enkil decided that he would himself address the demon who had come into his steward's house. This thing was out of harmony, he said. The royal magicians begged, of course, to be allowed to see this, to drive the demon out. But this was a king who would do good for everyone. He had some vision of all things being united in good, of all forces being made to go on the same divine course. He would speak to this demon, try to harness its power, so to speak, for the general good. And only if that could not be done would he consent to the demon's being driven out. And so he went into the house of his steward, where furniture was being flung at the walls, and jars broken, and doors slammed. And he commenced to talk to this demon, and invite it to talk to him. Everyone else ran away. A full night passed before he came out of the haunted house, and he had amazing things to say. "These demons are mindless and childlike," he told his magicians. "But I have studied their conduct, and I have learned from all the evidence why it is that they rage. They are maddened that they do not have bodies, that they cannot feel as we feel. They make the innocent scream filth, because the rites of love and passion are things that they cannot possibly know. They can work the body parts, but not truly inhabit them, and so they are obsessed with the flesh that they cannot invade, and with their feeble powers they bump upon objects, they make their victims twist and jump. This longing to be carnal is the origin of their anger, the indication of the suffering which is their lot." And with these pious words he prepared to lock himself in the haunted chambers to learn more. But this time his wife came between him and his purpose. She would not let him stay with the demons. He must look into the mirror, she said. He had aged remarkably in the few hours that he had remained in the house alone. And when he would not be deterred, she locked herself in with him, and all those who stood outside the house heard the crashing and banging of objects, and feared for the moment when they would hear the king and the queen themselves screaming or raging in spirit voices. The noise from the inner chambers was alarming. Cracks were appearing in the walls. All fled as before, except for a small party of interested men. Now these men, since the beginning of the reign, had been the enemies of the king. These were old warriors who had led the campaigns of Egypt in search of human flesh, and they had had enough of the king's goodness, enough of the good mother and farming and the like, and they saw in this spirit adventure not only more of the king's vain nonsense, but a situation that nevertheless provided a remarkable opportunity for them. When night fell they crept into the haunted house. They were fearless of spirits, just as the grave robbers are who rifle the tombs of the pharaohs. They believe, but not enough to control their greed. And when they saw Enkil and Akasha together in the middle of this room full of flying objects, they set upon them, and they stabbed the king over and over, as your Roman senators stabbed Caesar, and they stabbed the only witness, his wife. And the king cried out, "No, don't you see what you have done? You have given the spirits a way to get in. You have opened my body to them, don't you see?" But the men fled, sure of the death of the king and the queen, who was on her hands and knees, cradling her husband's head in her hands, both bleeding from more wounds than one could count. Now the conspirators stirred up the populace. Did everyone know that the king had been killed by the spirits? He should have left the demons to his magicians, as any other king would have done. And bearing torches, all flocked to the haunted house, which had grown suddenly and totally quiet. The conspirators urged the magicians to enter, but they were afraid. "Then we will go in and see what's happened," said the evil ones, and they threw open the doors. There stood the king and the queen, staring calmly at the conspirators, and all of their wounds were healed, and their eyes had taken on an eerie light, their skin a white shimmer, their hair a magnificent gleam. Out of the house they came as the conspirators ran in terror, and they dismissed all the people and the priests, and went back to the palace alone. And though they confided in no one, they knew what had happened to them. They had been entered through their wounds by the demon at the point when mortal life itself was about to escape. But it was the blood that the demon permeated in that twilight moment when the heart almost stopped. Perhaps it was the substance that he had always sought in his ragings, the substance that he had tried to bring forth from his victims with his antics, but he had never been able to inflict enough wounds before his victim died. But now he was in the blood, and the blood was not merely the demon or the blood of the king and queen, but a combination of the human and the demon, which was an altogether different thing. And all that was left of the king and queen was what this blood could animate, what it could infuse and claim for its own. Their bodies were for all other purposes dead, but the blood flowed through the brain, and through the heart, and through the skin, and so the intelligence of the king and queen remained. Their souls, if you will, remained, as the souls reside in these organs, though why we do not know. And though the demon blood had no mind of its own, no character of its own that the king and queen could discover, it nevertheless enhanced their minds and their characters, for it flowed through the organs that create thought, and it added to their faculties its purely spiritual powers, so that the king and queen could hear the thoughts of mortals, and sense things and understand things that mortals could not. In sum, the demon had added and the demon had taken away, and the king and queen were new things. They could no longer eat food, or grow, or die, or have children, yet they could feel with an intensity that terrified them, and the demon had what it wanted, a body to live in, a way to be in the world at last, a way to feel. But then came the even more dreadful discovery that to keep their corpses animate, the blood must be fed, and all it could convert to its use was the self-same thing of which it was made, blood. Give it more blood to enter, give it more blood to push through the limbs of the body in which it enjoyed such glorious sensations. Of blood it could not get enough. And oh, the grandest of all sensations was the drinking in which it renewed itself, fed itself, enlarged itself. And in that moment of drinking it could feel the death of the victim, the moment it pulled the blood so hard out of the victim that the victim's heart stopped. The demon had them. The king and queen. They were drinkers of the blood, and whether or not the demon knew of them, we will never be able to tell, but the king and queen knew that they had the demon and could not get rid of it, and if they did, they would die because their bodies were already dead. And they learned immediately that these dead bodies, animated as they were entirely by this demonic fluid, could not withstand fire or the light of the sun. On the one hand, they seemed as fragile white flowers that can be withered black in the daytime desert heat. On the other, it seemed the blood in them was so volatile that it would boil if heated, thereby destroying the fibers through which it moved. It has been said that in these very early times they could withstand no brilliant illumination, that even a nearby fire would cause their skin to smoke. Whatever, they were of a new order of being, and their thoughts were of a new order of being, and they tried to understand the things that they saw, the dispositions that afflicted them in this new state. All discoveries are not recorded. There is nothing in writing or in the unwritten tradition about when they first chose to pass on the blood, or ascertain the method by which it must be done, that the victim must be drained to the twilight moment of approaching death, or the demonic blood given him cannot take hold. We do know through the unwritten tradition that the king and queen tried to keep secret what had happened to them, but their disappearance by day aroused suspicions. They could not attend to the religious duties in the land. And so it came to pass that even before they had formed their clearest decisions, they had to encourage the populace to a worship of the good mother in the light of the moon. But they could not protect themselves from the conspirators, who still did not understand their recovery and sought to do away with them again. The attack came despite all precautions, and the strength of the king and the queen proved overwhelming to the conspirators, and they were all the more frightened by the fact that those wounds they managed to inflict upon the king and the queen were miraculously and instantly healed. An arm was severed from the king, and this he put back on his shoulder, and it came to life again, and the conspirators fled. And through these attacks, these battles, the secret came into the possession not only of the king's enemies, but the priests as well. And no one wanted to destroy the king and the queen now. Rather, they wanted to take them prisoner, and gain the secret of immortality from them. And they sought to take the blood from them, but their early attempts failed. The drinkers were not near to death, and so they became hybrid creatures, half god and half human, and they perished in horrible ways. Yet some succeeded. Perhaps they emptied their veins first. It isn't recorded. But in later ages, this was always proved a way to steal the blood. And perhaps the mother and the father chose to make fledglings. Maybe out of loneliness and fear, they chose to pass on the secret to those of good metal whom they could trust. Again, we are not told. Whatever the case, other drinkers of the blood did come into being, and a method of making them was eventually known. And the scrolls tell us that the mother and the father sought to triumph in their adversity. They sought to find some reason in what had happened, and they believed that their heightened senses must surely serve some good. The good mother had allowed this to happen, had she not? And they must sanctify and contain what was done by mystery, or else Egypt might become a race of blood-drinking demons who would divide the world into those who drink the blood and those who are bred only to give it. A tyranny that once achieved might never be broken by mortal men alone. And so the good king and queen chose the path of ritual, of myth. They saw in themselves the images of the waning and waxing moon, and in their drinking of the blood the god incarnate, who takes unto himself his sacrifice, and they used their superior powers to divine and predict and judge. And they saw themselves as truly accepting the blood for the god, which otherwise would run down the altar. They girded with the symbolic and the mysterious what could not be allowed to become common, and they passed out of the sight of mortal men into the temples, to be worshipped by those who would bring them blood. They took to themselves the most fit sacrifices, those that had always been made for the good of the land. Innocents, outsiders, evildoers, they drank the blood for the mother and for the good. They set into motion the tale of Osiris, composed in part of their own terrible suffering, the attack of the conspirators, the recovery, their need to live in the realm of darkness, the world beyond life, their inability to walk any more in sun. And they grafted this upon the older stories of the gods who rise and fall in their love of the good mother, which were already there in the land from which they came. And so these stories came down to us. These stories spread beyond the secret places in which the mother and the father were worshipped, in which those they made with the blood were installed. And they were already old when the first pharaoh built his first pyramid, and the earliest texts record them in broken and strange form. 100 other gods ruled in Egypt just as they rule in all lands, but the worship of the mother and father and those who drink the blood remained secret and powerful, a cult to which the devoted went to hear the silent voices of the gods, to dream their dreams. We are not told who were the first fledglings of the mother and father. We know only that they spread the religion to the islands of the great sea, and to the lands of the two rivers, and to the north woods. that enshrines everywhere the moon god ruled and drank his blood sacrifices, and used his powers to look into the hearts of men. During the periods between sacrifice, in starvation, the god's mind could leave his body. It could travel the heavens. He could learn a thousand things. And those mortals of the greatest purity of heart could come to the shrine and hear the voice of the god. And he could hear them. But even before my time, 1,000 years ago, this was all an old and incoherent story. The gods of the moon had ruled in Egypt for maybe 3,000 years, and the religion had been attacked again and again. When the Egyptian priests turned to the sun god Amon-Ra, they opened the crypts of the moon god and let the sun burn him to cinders. And many of our kind were destroyed. The same happened when the first rude warriors rode down into Greece and broke open the sanctuaries and killed what they did not understand. Now the babbling oracle of Delphi rules where we once ruled, and statues stand where we once stood. Our last hour is enjoyed in the north woods whence you came, among those who still drench our altars with the blood of the evildoer, and in the small villages of Egypt where one or two priests tend the god in the crypt, and allow the faithful to bring to him the evildoers, for they cannot take the innocent without arousing suspicion. And of evildoers and outsiders there are always some to be had. And down in the jungles of Africa, near the ruins of old cities that no one remembers, there too we are still obeyed.
But our history is punctuated by tales of rogues.
The drinkers of the blood who look to no goddess for guidance and have always used their powers as they chose. In Rome they live, in Athens, in all cities of the empire, those who hearken to no laws of right and wrong and use their powers for their own ends. And they died horribly in the heat and the flame, just as did the gods in the groves and the sanctuaries. And if any have survived, they probably do not even guess why they were subjected to the killing flame, of how the mother and the father were put into the sun.
He had stopped. He was studying my reaction. Their library was quiet, and if the others prowled behind the walls, I couldn't hear them any more. "I don't believe a word of it," I said. He stared at me in stupefied silence for a moment, and then he laughed and laughed. In a rage, I left the library and went out through the temple rooms and up through the tunnel and into the street.
11.
This was very uncharacteristic of me, to leave in temper, to break off abruptly and depart. I had never done that sort of thing when I was a mortal man. But as I've said, I was on the edge of madness, the first madness many of us suffer, especially those who have been brought into this by force. I went back to my little house near the great library of Alexandria, and I lay down on my bed as if I could really let myself fall asleep there and escape from this thing. "Idiot nonsense," I murmured to myself. But the more I thought about the story, the more it made sense. It made sense that something was in my blood, impelling me to drink more blood. It made sense that it heightened all sensations, that it kept my body, a mere imitation now of a human body, functioning when it should have come to a stop. And it made sense that this thing had no mind of its own, but was nevertheless a power, an organization of force with a desire to live all its own. And then it even made sense that we could all be connected to the mother and the father, because this thing was spiritual, and had no bodily limits except the limits of the individual bodies in which it had gained control. It was the vine, this thing, and we were the flowers, scattered over great distances, but connected by the twining tendrils that could reach all over the world. And this was why we gods could hear each other so well, why I could know the others were in Alexandria even before they called to me. It was why they could come and find me in my house, why they could lead me to the secret door. All right, maybe it was true. And it was an accident, this melding of an unnamed force and a human body and mind to make the new thing, as the elder had said. But still, I didn't like it. I revolted against all of it because if I was anything, I was an individual. A particular being with a strong sense of my own rights and prerogatives, I could not realize that I was host to an alien entity. I was still Marius, no matter what had been done to me. I was left, finally, with one thought and one thought only. If I was connected to this mother and father, then I must see them. And I must know that they were safe. I could not live with the thought that I could die at any moment on account of some alchemy I could neither control nor understand. But I didn't return to the underground temple. I spent the next few nights feasting on blood until my miserable thoughts were drowned in it, and then in the early hours I roamed the great library of Alexandria, reading as I had always done. Some of the madness dissolved in me. I stopped longing for my mortal family. I stopped being angry at that cursed thing in the cellar temple, and I thought rather of this new strength I possessed. I would live for centuries. I would know the answers to all kinds of questions. I would be the continual awareness of things as time passed, and as long as I slew only the evildoer, I could endure my bloodthirst, revel in it, in fact. And when the appropriate time came, I would make my companions and make them well. Now what remained? Go back to the elder and find out where he had put the mother and the father, and see these creatures for myself. And do the very thing the elder had threatened. Sink them so deep into the earth that no mortal could ever find them and expose them to the light. Easy to think about this. Easy to imagine them as so simply dispatched. 5 nights after I'd left the elder, when all these thoughts had had time to develop in me, I lay resting in my bedroom, with the lamps shining through the sheer bed curtains as before. In filtered and golden light, I listened to the sounds of sleeping Alexandria, and slipped into thin and glittering waking dreams. I wondered if the elder would come to me again, disappointed that I had not returned, and as the thought came clear to me, I realized that someone was standing in the doorway again. Someone was watching me. I could feel it. To see this person, I had but to turn my head, and then I would have the upper hand with the elder. I would say, "So you come out of loneliness and disillusionment, and now you want to tell me more, do you? Why don't you go back and sit in silence to wound your wraith-like companions, the Brotherhood of the Cinders?" Of course, I wouldn't say such a thing to him. But I wasn't above thinking about it, and letting him, if he was the one in the doorway, hear these thoughts. The one who was there did not go away. And slowly, I turned my eyes in the direction of the door. And it was a woman I saw standing there. And not merely a woman, but a magnificent, bronze-skinned Egyptian woman, as artfully bejeweled and dressed as the old queens, in fine pleated linen, with her black hair down to her shoulders, and braided with strands of gold. An immense force emanated from her, an invisible and commanding sense of her presence, her occupation of this small and insignificant room. I sat up and moved back the curtains, and the lamps in the room went out. I saw the smoke rising from them in the dark, grey wisps like snakes coiling towards the ceiling, and then gone. She was still there, the remaining light defining her expressionless face, sparkling on the jewels around her neck and in her large, almond-shaped eyes. And silently she said, "Marius, take us out of Egypt." And then she was gone. My heart was knocking in me uncontrollably. I went into the garden looking for her. I leapt over the wall and stood alone listening in the empty, unpaved street. I started to run towards the old section where I had found the door. I meant to get into the underground temple and find the elder and tell him that he must take me to her. I had seen her. She had moved. She had spoken. She had come to me. I was delirious. But when I reached the door, I knew that I didn't have to go down. I knew that if I went out of the city into the sands, I could find her. She was already leading me to where she was. In that hour that followed, I was to remember the strength and the speed I'd known in the forests of Gaul, and had not used since. I went out from the city to where the stars provided the only light, and I walked until I came to a ruined temple, and there I began to dig in the sand. It would have taken a band of mortals several hours to discover the trap door, but I found it quickly, and I was able to lift it, which mortals couldn't have done. The twisting stairs and corridors I followed were not illuminated, and I cursed myself for not bringing a candle, for being so swept off my feet by the sight of her that I had rushed after her as if I were in love. "Help me, Akasha," I whispered. I put my hands out in front of me and tried not to feel mortal fear of the blackness in which I was as blind as an ordinary man. My hands touched something hard before me, and I rested, catching my breath, trying to command myself. Then my hands moved on the thing and felt what seemed the chest of a human statue, its shoulders, its arms. But this was no statue, this thing. This thing was made of something more resilient than stone, and when my hand found the face, the lips proved just a little softer than all the rest of it, and I drew back. I could hear my heart beat. I could feel the sheer humiliation of cowardice. I didn't dare say the name, Akasha. I knew that this thing I had touched had a man's form. It was Enkil. I closed my eyes, trying to gather my wits, form some plan of action that didn't include turning and running like a madman, and I heard a dry crackling sound, and against my closed lids saw fire. When I opened my eyes, I saw a blazing torch on the wall beyond him, and his dark outline looming before me, and his eyes animate, and looking at me without question, the black pupils swimming in a dull grey light. He was otherwise lifeless, hands limp at his sides. He was ornamented as she had been, and he wore the glorified dress of the pharaoh, and his hair, too, was plaited with gold. His skin was bronze all over, as hers had been. Enhanced, as the elder had said. And he was the incarnation of menace in his stillness as he stood staring at me. In the barren chamber behind him, she sat on a stone shelf, with her head at an angle, her arms dangling, as if she were a lifeless body flung there. Her linen was smeared with sand, her sandaled feet caked with it, and her eyes were vacant and staring. Perfect attitude of death. And he, like a stone sentinel in a royal tomb, blocked my path. I could hear no more from either of them than you heard from them when I took you down to the chamber here on the island, and I thought I might expire on the spot from fear. Yet there was the sand on her feet and on her linen. She'd come to me. She had. But someone had come into the corridor behind me. Someone was shuffling along the passage, and when I turned, I saw one of the burnt ones, a mere skeleton, this one, with black gums showing, and the fangs cutting into the shiny black raisin skin of his lower lip. I swallowed a gasp at the sight of him, his bony limbs, feet splayed, arms jiggling with every step. He was ploughing towards us, but he did not seem to see me. He put his hands up and shoved at Enkil. "No, no, back into the chamber," he whispered in a low, crackling voice. "No, no," and each syllable seemed to take all he had. His withered arms shoved at the figure. He couldn't budge it. "Help me," he said to me. "They have moved. Why did they move? Make them go back. The further they move, the harder it is to get them back." I stared at Enkil, and I felt the horror that you felt, to see this statue with life in it, seemingly unable or unwilling to move. And as I watched, the spectacle grew even more horrible, because the blackened wraith was now screaming and scratching at Enkil, unable to do anything with him. And the sight of this thing that should have been dead, wearing itself out like this, and this other thing that looked so perfectly godlike and magnificent, just standing there, was more than I could bear. "Help me," the thing said. "Get him back into the chamber. Get them back where they must remain." How could I do this? How could I lay hands on this being? How could I presume to push him where he did not wish to go? "They will be all right if you help me," the thing said. "They will be together, and they will be at peace. Push on him. Do it. Push. Oh, look at her. What's happened to her? Look." All right, damn it, I whispered, and overcome with shame I tried. I laid my hands again on Enkel, and I pushed at him. But it was impossible. My strength meant nothing here, and the burnt one became all the more irritating with his useless ranting and shoving. But then he gasped and cackled and threw his skeletal arms up in the air and backed up. "What's the matter with you?" I said, trying not to scream and run, but I saw soon enough. Akasha had appeared behind Enkel. She was standing directly behind him and looking at me over his shoulder, and I saw her fingertips come round his muscular arms. Her eyes were as empty in their glazed beauty as they had been before, but she was making him move. And now came the spectacle of these two things walking of their own volition, he backing up slowly, feet barely leaving the ground, and she shielded by him so that I saw only her hands and the top of her head and her eyes. I blinked, trying to clear my head. They were sitting on the shelf again, together, and they had lapsed into the same posture in which you saw them downstairs, on this island, tonight. The burnt creature was near to collapse. He had gone down on his knees, and he didn't have to explain to me why. He had found them many a time in different positions, but he had never witnessed their movement, and he had never seen her as she had been before. I was bursting with the knowledge of why she had been as she was before. She had come to me. But there was a point at which my pride and exhilaration gave way to what it should have been, overwhelming awe and finally grief. I started to cry uncontrollably, as I had not cried since I had been with the old god in the grove, and my death had occurred, and this curse, this great, luminous and powerful curse, had descended on me. I cried as you cried when you first saw them. I cried for their stillness and their isolation, and this horrid little place in which they stared forward at nothing, or sat in darkness while Egypt died above. The goddess, the mother, the thing, whatever she was, the mindless and silent or helpless progenitor, was looking at me. Surely it wasn't an illusion. Her great glossy eyes, with their black fringe of lashes, were fixed upon me. And there came her voice again. But it had nothing of its old power. It was merely the thought, quite beyond language, inside my head. "Take us out of Egypt, Marius. The Elder means to destroy us. Guard us, Marius, or we perish here."
"Do they want blood?" the burnt one cried. "Did they move because they would have sacrifice?"
the dried one begged. "Go get them a sacrifice," I said.
"I cannot now. I haven't the strength, and they won't give their healing blood to me. Would they but allow me a few drops, my burnt flesh might restore itself. The blood in me would be replenished, and I should bring them glorious sacrifices."
But there was an element of dishonesty in this little speech, because they didn't desire glorious sacrifices any more. "Try again to drink their blood," I said, and this was horribly selfish of me. I just wanted to see what would happen. Yet to my humiliation, he did approach them, bent over and weeping, begging them to give their powerful blood, their old blood, so that his burns might heal faster, saying that he was innocent. He had not put them in the sand. It had been the Elder. Please, please, would they let him drink from the original fount? And then ravenous hunger consumed him, and, convulsing, he distended his fangs as a cobra might, and he shot forward, his black claws out to the neck of Enkel. Enkil's arm rose as the Elder said it would, and flung the burnt one across the chamber on his back before it returned to its proper place. The burnt one was sobbing, and I was even more ashamed. The burnt one was too weak to hunt for victims or bring victims. I had urged him on to this to see it. And the gloom of the place, the gritty sand on the floor, the barrenness, the stink of the torch, and the ugly sight of the burnt one writhing and crying, all this was dispiriting beyond words. "Then drink from me," I said, shuddering at the sight of him, the fangs distended again, the hands out to grasp me. But it was the least I could do.
12.
As soon as I was done with that creature, I ordered him to let no one enter the crypt. How the hell he was supposed to keep anyone out, I couldn't imagine, but I told him this with tremendous authority, and I hurried away. I went back into Alexandria, and I broke into a shop that sold antique things, and I stole 2 fine painted and gold-plated mummy cases, and I took a great deal of linen for wrapping, and I went back to the desert crypt. My courage and my fear were at their peak. As often happens when we give the blood or take it from another of our kind, I had seen things, dreamed things, as it were, when the burnt one had his teeth in my throat. And what I had seen and dreamed had to do with Egypt, the age of Egypt, the fact that for 4,000 years this land had known little change in language, religion, or art. And for the first time this was understandable to me, and it put me in profound sympathy with the mother and the father as relics of this country, as surely as the pyramids were relics. It intensified my curiosity and made it something more akin to devotion. Though, to be honest, I would have stolen the mother and the father just in order to survive. This new knowledge, this new infatuation inspired me, as I approached Akasha and Enkil, to put them in the wooden mummy cases, knowing full well that Akasha would allow it and that one blow from Enkil could probably crush my skull. But Enkil yielded as well as Akasha. They allowed me to wrap them in linen, to make mummies of them, and to place them into the shapely wooden coffins which bore the painted faces of others, and the endless hieroglyph instructions for the dead, and to take them with me into Alexandria, which I did. I left the wraith being in a terrible state of agitation as I went off, dragging a mummy case under each arm. When I reached the city, I hired men to carry these coffins properly to my house, out of a sense of fittingness. And then I buried them deep beneath the garden, explaining to Akasha and Enkil all the while aloud that their stay in the earth would not be long. I was in terror to leave them the next night. I hunted and killed within yards of my own garden gate, and then I sent my slaves to purchase horses and a wagon for me, and to make preparations for a journey around the coast to Antioch on the Orontes River, a city I knew and loved, and in which I felt I would be safe. As I feared, the elder soon appeared. I was actually waiting for him in the shadowy bedroom, seated on my couch like a Roman, one lamp beside me, an old copy of some Roman poem in my hand. I wondered if he would sense the location of Akasha and Enkil, and deliberately imagined false things, that I had shut them up in the Great Pyramid itself. I still dreamed the dream of Egypt that had come to me from the Burnt One, a land in which the laws and the beliefs had remained the same for longer than we could imagine, a land that had known the picture writing and the pyramids and the myths of Osiris and Isis when Greece had been in darkness and when there was no Rome. I saw the river Nile overflowing her banks. I saw the mountains on either side which created the valley. I saw time with a wholly different idea of it. And it was not merely the dream of the Burnt One. It was all I had ever seen or known in Egypt, a sense of things beginning there which I had learned from books long before I had become the child of the mother and the father, whom I meant now to take.
"What makes you think that we would entrust them to you?" the elder said as soon as he appeared in the doorway.
He appeared enormous as, girded only in the short linen kilt, he walked around my room. The lamplight shone on his bald head, his round face, his bulging eyes.
"How dare you take the mother and the father? What have you done with them?" he said.
"It was you who put them in the sun," I answered. "You who sought to destroy them. You were the one who didn't believe the old story. You were the guardian of the mother and the father, and you lied to me. You brought about the death of our kind from one end of the world to the other. You, and you lied to me." He was dumbfounded. He thought me proud and impossible beyond words. So did I. But so what? He had the power to burn me to ashes if and when he burnt the mother and the father. And she had come to me. to me.
I did not know what would happen, he said now,
his veins cording against his forehead, his fists clenched. He looked like a great, bald Nubian as he tried to intimidate me.
I swear to you, by all that is sacred, I didn't know. And you cannot know what it means to keep them, to look at them year after year, decade after decade, century after century, and know that they could speak, they could move, and they will not.
I had no sympathy for him and what he said. He was merely an enigmatic figure poised in the center of this small room in Alexandria, railing at me of sufferings beyond the imagination. How could I sympathize with him?
I inherited them, he said. They were given to me. What was I to do? He declared. And I must contend with their punishing silence, their refusal to direct the tribe they had loosed into the world. And why came this silence? Vengeance, I tell you, vengeance on us. But for what? Who exists who can remember back 1,000 years now? No one. Who understands all these things? The old gods go into the sun, into the fire, or they meet with obliteration through violence, or they bury themselves in the deepest earth, never to rise again. But the mother and the father go on forever, and they do not speak. Why don't they bury themselves where no harm can come to them? Why do they simply watch and listen and refuse to speak? Only when one tries to take Akasha from Enkil does he move. Does he strike out and then batter down his foes as if he were a stone colossus come to life? I tell you, when I put them in the sand, they did not try to save themselves. They stood facing the river as I ran.
You did it to see what would happen, if it would make them move.
To free myself! To say, I will keep you no longer. Move. Speak. To see if it was true, the old story. And if it was true, then let us all die in flames.
He had exhausted himself.
In a feeble voice he said finally, You cannot take the mother and the father. How could you think that I would allow you to do this? You who might not last out this century. You who ran from the obligations of the grove. You don't really know what the mother and the father are. You have heard more than one lie from me.
I have something to tell you, I said. You are free now. You know that we're not gods, and we're not men either. We don't serve the Mother Earth because we do not eat her fruits, and we do not naturally descend to her embrace. We are not of her. And I leave Egypt without further obligation to you, and I take them with me because it is what they have asked me to do, and I will not suffer them or me to be destroyed. He was again dumbfounded. How had they asked me? But he couldn't find words. He was so angry, and so full of hatred suddenly, and so full of dark, wrathful secrets that I could not even glimpse. He had a mind as educated as mine, this one, but he knew things about our powers that I didn't guess. I had never slain a man when I was mortal. I did not know how to kill any living thing save in the tender and remorseless need for blood. He knew how to use his supernatural strength. He closed his eyes to slits and his body hardened. Danger radiated from him. He approached me and his intentions went before him. And in an instant I had risen off my couch, and I was trying to ward off his blows. He had me by the throat, and he threw me against the stone wall so that the bones of my shoulder and right arm were crushed. In a moment of exquisite pain I knew he would dash my head against the stone and crush all my limbs, and then he would pour the oil of the lamp over me and burn me, and I would be gone out of his private eternity as if I had never known these secrets or dared to intrude. I fought as I never could have before, but my battered arm was a riot of pain, and his strength was to me what mine would be to you. But instead of clawing at his hands as they locked round my throat, instead of trying to free my throat as was instinctive, I shot my thumbs into his eyes. Though my arm blazed with pain, I used all my strength to push his eyes backwards into his head. He let go of me. And he wailed. Blood was pouring down his face. I ran clear of him and towards the garden door.
I still could not breathe from the damage he'd done to my throat, and as I clutched at my dangling arm, I saw things out of the corner of my eye that confused me. A great spray of earth, flying up from the garden, the air dense as if with smoke. I bumped the doorframe, losing my balance, as if a wind had moved me, and glancing back I saw him coming on, eyes still glittering, though from deep inside his head. He was cursing me in Egyptian. He was saying that I should go into the netherworld with the demons unmourned. And then his face froze in a mask of fear. He stopped in his tracks and looked almost comical in his alarm. Then I saw what he saw, the figure of Akasha, who moved past me to my right. The linen wrapping had been ripped from around her head, and her arms were torn free, and she was covered with the sandy earth. Her eyes had the same expressionless stare they always had, and she bore down on him slowly, drawing ever closer because he could not move to save himself. He went down on his knees, babbling to her in Egyptian, first with a tone of astonishment and then with incoherent fright. Still she came on, tracking the sand after her, the linen falling off her as each slow, sliding step ruptured the wrappings more violently. He turned away and fell forward on his hands and started to crawl as if, by some unseen force, she prevented him from rising to his feet. Surely that was what she was doing, because he lay prone finally, his elbows jutting up, unable to move himself. Quietly and slowly, she stepped on the back of his right knee, crushing it flat beneath her foot, the blood squirting from under her heel. And with the next step she crushed his pelvis just as flat, while he roared like a dumb beast, the blood gushing from his mangled parts. Then came her next step down upon his shoulder, and the next upon his head, which exploded beneath her weight as if it had been an acorn. The roaring ceased. The blood spurted from all his remains as they twitched. Turning, she revealed to me no change in expression, signifying nothing of what had happened to him, indifferent even to the lone and horrified witness who shrank back against the wall. She walked back and forth over his remains with the same slow and effortless gait, and crushed the last of him utterly. What was left was not even the outline of a man, but mere blood-soaked pulp upon the floor. And yet it glittered, bubbled, seemed to swell and contract as if there were still life in it. I was petrified, knowing that there was life in it, that this was what immortality could mean. But she had come to a stop, and she turned to her left so slowly it seemed the revolution of a statue on a chain, and her hand rose, and the lamp beside the couch rose in the air and fell down upon the bloody mass, the flame quickly igniting the oil as it spilled. "Like grease," he went up, flames dancing from one end of the dark mass to the other, the blood seeming to feed the fire, the smoke acrid but only with the stench of the oil. I was on my knees, with my head against the side of the doorway. I was as near to losing consciousness from shock as I have ever been. I watched him burn to nothing. I watched her standing there, beyond the flames, her bronze face giving forth not the slightest sign of intelligence or triumph or will. I held my breath, expecting her eyes to move to me. But they didn't, and as the moment lengthened, as the fire died, I realized that she had ceased to move. She had returned to the state of absolute silence and stillness that all the others had come to expect of her. The room was dark now. The fire had gone out. The smell of burning oil sickened me. She looked like an Egyptian ghost in her torn wrappings, poised there before the glittering embers, the gilded furnishings glinting in the light from the sky, bearing, for all their Roman craftsmanship, some resemblance to the elaborate and delicate furnishings of a royal burial chamber. I rose to my feet, and the pain in my shoulder and in my arm throbbed. I could feel the blood rushing to heal it, but the damage was considerable. I did not know how long I would have this. I did know, of course, that if I were to drink from her, the healing would be much faster, perhaps instantaneous, and we could start our journey out of Alexandria tonight. I could take her far, far away from Egypt. Then I realized that she was telling me this. The words, far, far away, were breathed in by me sensuously. And I answered her, I have been all through the world, and I will take you to safe places. But then again, perhaps this dialogue was all my doing, and the soft, yielding sensation of love for her was my doing, and I was going completely mad, knowing this nightmare would never, never end except in fires such as that, that no natural old age or death would ever quiet my fears and dull my pains, as I had once expected it to do. It ceased to matter. What mattered was that I was alone with her, and in this darkness she might have been a human woman standing there, a young god-woman full of vitality and full of lovely language and ideas and dreams. I moved closer to her, and it seemed then that she was this pliant and yielding creature, and some knowledge of her was inside me, waiting to be remembered, waiting to be enjoyed. Yet I was afraid. She could do to me what she had done to the elder. But that was absurd. She would not. I was her guardian now. She would never let anyone hurt me. No, I was to understand that. And I came closer and closer to her, until my lips were almost at her bronze throat. And it was decided when I felt the firm, cold press of her hand on the back of my head. 13. I won't try to describe the ecstasy. You know it. You knew it when you took the blood from Magnus. You knew it when I gave you the blood in Cairo. You know it when you kill. And you know what it means when I say it was that, but a thousand times that. I neither saw, nor heard, nor felt anything but absolute happiness. Absolute satisfaction. Yet I was in other places, other rooms from long ago, and voices were talking and battles were being lost. Someone was crying in agony. Someone was screaming in words I knew and didn't know. I do not understand. I do not understand. A great pool of darkness opened, and there came the invitation to fall and to fall and to fall. And she sighed and said, I can fight no longer. Then I awoke, and found myself lying on my couch. She was in the center of the room still as before, and it was late in the night, and the city of Alexandria murmured around us in its sleep. I knew a multitude of other things. I knew so many things that it would have taken hours, if not nights, for me to learn them if they'd been confided in mortal words. And I had no inkling of how much time had passed. I knew that thousands of years ago there had been great battles among the drinkers of the blood, and many of them after the first creation had become ruthless and profane bringers of death, unlike the benign lovers of the good mother who starved and then drank her sacrifices. These were death angels who could swoop down upon any victim at any moment, glorying in the conviction that they were part of the rhythm of all things in which no individual human life matters, in which death and life are equal, and to them belonged suffering and slaughter as they chose to mete it out. And these terrible gods had their devoted worshippers among men, human slaves who brought victims to them, and quaked in fear of the moment when they themselves might fall to the gods' whim. Gods of this kind had ruled in ancient Babylon, and in Assyria, and in cities long forgotten, and in far-off India, and in countries beyond whose names I did not understand. And even now, as I sat silent and stunned by these images, I understood that these gods had become part of the Oriental world which was alien to the Roman world to which I'd been born. They were part of the world of the Persians, whose men were abject slaves to their king, while the Greeks who had fought them had been free men. No matter what our cruelties and our excesses, even the lowliest peasant had value to us. Life had value. And death was merely the end of life, something to be faced with bravery when honor left no choice. Death was not grand to us. In fact, I don't think death was anything really to us. It certainly was not a state preferable to life. And though these gods had been revealed to me by Akasha in all their grandeur and mystery, I found them appalling.